From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the history of President Bush's war cabinet. We talk with James Mann. His new book, The Rise of the Vulcans, is about the backgrounds and beliefs of Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, and Richard Armitage, and how they've shaped the way in which the Bush administration has dealt with the rest of the world. Also, a look behind the scenes of Curb Your Enthusiasm, the HBO series starring Larry David as a more neurotic, self-absorbed version of himself. We'll talk with Robert Whitey, an executive producer and director of the series. Whitey has also directed documentaries about Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. John Allen Muhammad has been sentenced to death for the sniper murder of a Maryland man in October of 2002. The killing was one of 10 in the Washington area linked to the 42-year-old drifter and his teenage companion. Larry Myers, the older brother of sniper victim Dean Myers, said he expected the judge to choose death for Muhammad.
I've always been comfortable with whatever the decision was going to be, so I just took it in stride. I was anticipating he was going to say that just from his body language and what I saw going on, so that wasn't a big shock or surprise.
Muhammad's accomplice, Lee Boyd Malvo, is scheduled to receive a life prison sentence tomorrow. CIA Director George Tenet told the Senate Armed Services Committee that he doesn't think Bush administration officials manipulated the facts to justify the war in Iraq. Tenet added, though, that policymakers' interpretations don't always match the data given to them by the intelligence agency. He said he spoke up when he believed that someone in the government was misconstruing intelligence. Turkish officials say two suicide bombers attacked a Masonic lodge in Istanbul today. One attacker and one civilian were killed. Dorian Jones says one of the would-be suicides reportedly survived.
One of the attackers appears still to be alive. He was rushed to hospital and, according to one witness, was shouting obscenities towards Israel. Another witness said that as they were attacking the Masonic Lodge, they were shouting, "God is great." So it appears to be radical Islamic-motivated attack.
Jones says that Islamic fundamentalists have long regarded the Masonic order with suspicion. Voters in four states go to the polls in primary elections today, and the turnout in the president's home state of Texas is expected to be low. Bill Zeeble reports from KERA in Dallas.
The Texas Secretary of State predicts a 14% voter turnout, or about 1.7 million people. The top race for president is no contest in either party, so interest falls to candidates farther down the ballot, including the 32 congressional districts. Those boundaries were significantly redrawn to favor Republicans in controversial, partisan fighting that lasted months. The battles also involved Texas Democratic legislators who left the state capitol hoping to stop the remapping process. With new district bounds finally approved by legislators, then confirmed in federal court, Republicans hope to gain up to 7 additional congressional seats this fall. For NPR News, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
People in Florida, Louisiana, and Mississippi are also voting in primaries today. Election officials in Florida say there have been no problems so far with procedures that were set up to avoid irregularities like the ones that marred the 2000 election. In stocks, the Dow lost 72 to close at 10,457. The NASDAQ was down 13 to 1995. This is NPR News. Attorney General John Ashcroft is reported to have come through well from an operation to remove his gallbladder today. The doctor who performed the surgery said it was done to prevent a recurrence of a painful bout of pancreatitis that sent Ashcroft to the hospital on Thursday. A top U.S. military commander said today that Marines in Haiti were justified in using lethal force in two separate incidents in recent days. NPR's Eric Westervelt has more.
There are now 1,600 American troops in Haiti as part of a 2,300-strong international force. Twice this week, U.S. Marines have used deadly force on Haitians, including an incident last night when a car sped toward a U.S. checkpoint and Marines opened fire, killing the driver. General Peter Pace, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says the Marines' actions were fully justified.
An individual Marine has an individual service member. In this case, a Marine has the absolute right to defend himself and those around him. And when someone threatens force, as was done last night, They get dealt with as they were dealt with last night.
Meantime, the head of the African Union, which supports trans-African cooperation, today called for a United Nations investigation into the circumstances surrounding the U.S.-prompted exile of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, The Pentagon.
A court-martial date has been set for a U.S. Army sergeant who's accused of killing two officers in a grenade attack in Kuwait at the start of the Iraq War. Hassan Akbar is charged with two counts of premeditated murder and three counts of attempted murder. Prosecutors say the 32-year-old sergeant stole grenades from a Humvee he was guarding and used them in an attack that left an Army captain and Air Force major dead. A lawyer for Akbar said there were no witnesses who placed his client at the scene. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In an attempt to explain how the Bush administration is dealing with the rest of the world, my guest James Mann has written a new book about the president's foreign policy team. The book traces the history of six of its leading members: Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of State Colin Powell, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, and Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage. They all worked on foreign policy in previous Republican administrations and, according to Mann, represent the generation that bridged the Cold War and post-Cold War. During the presidential campaign of 2000, Bush's foreign policy advisors called their team the Vulcans after the Roman god of fire, the forge, and metalwork. James Mann's new book is called Rise of the Vulcans: The History of Bush's War Cabinet. Mann is a former correspondent for the L.A. Times and is now senior writer-in-residence at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. What holds the people in this book together?
Well, the simplest answer, of course, is that they all sit around the table in the Bush administration's foreign policy decision deliberations. They're the six, other than the president, the six most senior people on the Bush foreign policy team. Beyond that, however, I argue in the book that there are a series of underlying attitudes and assumptions and values. One, of course, is a belief in the overwhelming importance of military power for the United States, a certain reluctance to engage in accommodations with other countries, a very optimistic, expansive view of America's power and capabilities, and a belief in American values such as democracy and the idea that they should be, that other countries should take them on.
And these are views that you believe are behind the invasion of Iraq as well?
Well, I think they're part of the administration's mindset that led to the invasion of Iraq, yes.
Now, let's talk about some of the connections between the six people you write about in the book, especially the connections between Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. You say that they have an especially strong connection that dates back to the Nixon administration, when Dick Cheney was Donald Rumsfeld's administrative assistant. You describe them as a complementary pair. In what way?
Complementary in the sense that while they thought alike, their personalities were so different, and have been for 30 years. So Rumsfeld is very aggressively outgoing. Cheney is quiet and discreet. Rumsfeld is openly ambitious. Sort of never meets a next job he didn't want. Cheney is, at least on the surface, very low keyed and unambitious. And so their personalities sort of matched one another, while their interests in policy tended to be the same.
You say that Dick Cheney rose to the top by taking care of the mundane chores that people with larger egos avoid. What are some examples of that?
Well, I use the examples in the Ford administration, in the Ford White House. I was struck, as I was researching this book and going through the Ford archives, at some of the memos that Cheney wrote as deputy White House chief of staff. He was the assistant to Don Rumsfeld. And this is really Cheney's start in the White House. And what he was taking care of, there are memos about the White House plumbing. There are memos about the Christmas card lists. There are memos about, please get a headrest for Betty Ford on the helicopter. He really was taking care of all the little details that needed to be taken care of. Salt shakers, what was served at White House stag dinners. And he was so efficient and reliable that, of course, he kept on rising. I think we all know people in organizations who kind of get there a little earlier, are quiet, little heard from, leave later, and then get things done. And that was Cheney's attribute. Of course, from that, then once they see that he's efficient and discreet, he takes on substantive areas. And interestingly enough, in the Ford White House, intelligence was one of the first.
You say that Dick Cheney's Secret Service code name used to be Backseat. When did he get that?
He got that, again, during the Ford administration when he was, again, Don Rumsfeld was the dominant personality in that Ford White House. He was the White House chief of staff. He was doing battle with other large figures like Henry Kissinger, and Cheney was his assistant. He was Backseat.
And that's not his nickname anymore for the Secret Service, is it?
No.
I didn't think so. It's interesting how you chart the rise of the six people in the Bush War Cabinet who you profile in your new book. Some of them have changed a lot. Some of them you see consistent threads throughout their career. There's something about Donald Rumsfeld that seems to have changed a lot. During the Nixon years, Rumsfeld was the person who was considered anti-war and almost dangerously so. What was his position about the Vietnam War?
I was surprised. I was going through the Nixon White House recordings, which all who listen to are always riveted with how interesting they are. And it turned out that Don Rumsfeld, really within the Nixon White House, was kind of pushing for a quick American withdrawal from Vietnam. He was something of a dove, not outside, not in public, but he was the center of what I would call a cluster of domestic policy advisors who really thought that the war and the continuation of the war, which was then dragging on, you know, fifth, sixth year, was diverting America's resources and energy away from domestic programs. And Rumsfeld was involved in domestic programs then. And he and some other domestic advisors, another was George Shultz, kept pushing within the Nixon White House to set a date or to somehow figure out how to get American troops out.
Another thing that's hard to imagine now is that Donald Rumsfeld was considered to be the Nixon administration's link to the young people on the college campuses.
Well, that was over 30 years ago. Rumsfeld was young. What was one of the younger and more dynamic members of the Nixon administration? Most of Nixon's other advisors were not political figures. They weren't people who could go out on their own around the country to sell the Nixon administration. Rumsfeld was. Rumsfeld was unique in the sense that he'd run for elective office. He'd been a member of Congress for about 6 years. And Nixon always saw him as the guy he wanted out selling the administration.
What are President George W. Bush's connections? What were his connections when he was choosing his cabinet to Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld?
Very interesting. Bush's father, George Bush Sr., Bush 41, as he's sometimes called, was something of a political rival of Rumsfeld. That dated back to the 1970s. Each, I think, saw himself as a possible moderate Republican candidate for president. And beyond that, the senior Bush thought that Rumsfeld had undercut him in an effort to become the vice presidential nominee in 1976. So there's a longtime rivalry between Rumsfeld and Bush Sr. Although I was told in interviews for the book that it kind of passed by 2001. After the 2000 election, as George W. Bush, Bush 43, as he's known, began to put together his foreign policy team, The original idea, the original thinking, was that Don Rumsfeld would be appointed director of the CIA. And other candidates were being considered for Secretary of Defense. Senator Coates at the time was the leading candidate. And then within the Bush team, the inner circle, two things happened. One, there was a concern about getting an extremely strong, knowledgeable Secretary of Defense, an experienced Secretary of Defense, to counterweight the influence of Colin Powell within the administration. Secondly, from a different direction, the current president's father, George Bush Sr., was concerned that there not be a change in the position of CIA director at the beginning of a new administration. He thought that that would make it seem like it was a political appointment, and he didn't believe it should be.
What were the connections to President George W. Bush and now Vice President Dick Cheney before the presidential campaign? Were those connections largely through the president's father, George Bush Sr.?
Yes, they were. I'm sure that the current president saw Cheney as part of the older generation associated with his father and with his father's administration.
My guest is James Mann. His new book is called Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Mann. He's the author of the new book, Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. One of the questions that a lot of people have been asking is, was regime change in Iraq on the Bush administration agenda before September 11th? Was September 11th a kind of convenient explanation or excuse to do something that the Bush administration war cabinet wanted to do anyways? From your investigation into the lives and the politics of the people in the war cabinet, what are your observations on that?
Yeah, good question. From what I've seen, one has to draw a distinction between regime change and serious military planning. Regime change in Iraq was the policy of this current administration from the time it took office, and also, however, of the Clinton administration in its last couple of years. They were formally for a policy of regime change starting in, I believe it was, 98. The new the Bush administration took office, certainly also believed in regime change. But there's a difference between a policy of regime change or a desire to change regimes and serious military planning for an invasion. And at least from what I've seen, the serious military planning was not at the beginning of this Bush administration. It really was. It was after September 11th. It sort of the end of 2001, early 2002, and in that year leading up to the war. If you remember right, from about the time Bush took office until September 11th. There was some selective attention given to Iraq, but the dominant American Bush administration policy, which didn't work and which was controversial, had to do with sanctions, what were called smart sanctions. Again, the serious military planning is not at in the early months of this administration.
After September 11th, Vice President Cheney went to an undisclosed location for his safety. And you say that this goes back to a strategy from the Reagan administration, a highly classified program. Describe what that program was.
It was run by a secret unit called the National Program Office. The Reagan administration was concerned about keeping the American government and obviously including the American military running during or after a nuclear war. And what they decided was this, that they would send out, if nuclear war was imminent, they would send out three teams, large teams, 60, 70 people around the country, different locations. Each team would be trained, essentially, to govern the United States after a nuclear war. And each team had kind of a chief of staff to run the team. One of the chiefs of staff was Dick Cheney, who was then in Congress. And the second team was headed by Don Rumsfeld, who was then a business executive in Chicago. But, of course, both of these men had had experience, you know, real-life experience as White House chiefs of staff. This wasn't some paper exercise. I mean, you know, once or twice a year, these teams would be secretly sent out in the middle of the night from Andrews Air Force Base to some abandoned schoolyard. I think they spent two or three days eating MREs, meals ready to eat, the early versions. The Reagan administration, without telling the country, was really practicing for what might happen and how the country would be run in nuclear war. The program itself was phased out during the Clinton years. The Cold War ended. But some of the ideas, some of the approaches of that program carry over after September 11th. So Cheney goes off to undisclosed locations. Teams of federal officials are sent out immediately after September 11th to live and practice getting ready to run the country in other locations outside of Washington.
How did you learn about this secret plan?
In reporting this book for 2 years, I talked to as many people as I could. What do you know about these people? And in asking about Cheney and Rumsfeld, I first began to get hints from a couple of people. There's one person who said, well, I first got to know them in a classified program that I can't tell you about. And, you know, later on, a couple people who participated in the program provided a few more details, and I began to piece it together.
What's something that really surprised you that you learned during your research for your book about the Bush War Cabinet, something that we haven't touched on?
You know, one of the things that surprised me is to go through the 1990s and see how this team gradually developed its views. You know, the general perception, conventional wisdom, is the first Bush administration left office in 1992, and then 8 years later, the same group of people come together again. And, you know, they're supposed to start up where they left off, but they don't. If you go through that period from 1992 and 3 to 2000, what you find is that the center of gravity in the Republican Party shifts dramatically in a more conservative direction, that many of the positions that George W. Bush took in the 2000 campaign were not new to him. They were positions very similar to what Bob Dole laid out in 1996, support of missile defense, a tough line on North Korea and China and so on. It was the party as a whole that shifted. Donald Rumsfeld had been out of public life, as far as people saw, from the 70s until 2001. What I found in going through the 1990s was that most, and the important word is most, of the members of the Vulcans had really been gradually working together, sharing ideas, talking about policy through the 1990s in a bunch of forums. That there were a bunch of different places where Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, and Donald Rumsfeld were sitting down talking about ideas, talking about policy. The other part of that is Colin Powell was not at the table. That the Bush campaign of 2000 saw Colin Powell as important politically. He spoke at the convention in 2000. He was out there, but he wasn't part of these internal deliberations. There was one study group on missile defense. Most people were at it. Colin Powell wasn't. There was a congressional study group on foreign policy. Most of these other people were at it. Colin Powell wasn't. So you see that the divisions that we now see with this team in office were there in the 1990s. Just no one saw them.
You know, some people will read your book and think, I see a pattern here. These people were all, the people in the War Cabinet have been allied with each other for years. They had certain things on their agenda for years, like a military presence in the Gulf. Therefore, some people will say, it must be some kind of, like, heavy agenda that brings these people together again in the Bush administration, almost to the point of a conspiracy. You know, people will read that. Some people will read that into your book. What would you say to those who do?
No, I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think I'm interested in history. In history, a lot of things happen by chance. A lot of things just happen. I don't think this is, a group of people sitting down together and deciding on a conspiracy or a plot many years before. There are disagreements among these people. I've seen sometimes people talk about the neoconservatives plotting things that happened when this team took office. Of course, what that leaves out is that in the 2000 campaign, the neoconservatives didn't even support George Bush. They were supporting his Republican opponent, John McCain. This is a group of people who served together in several different administrations. They got to know one another. Because Republicans won 6 out of the previous 9 presidential elections, I think it is, they had worked together. Sometimes they were friends, sometimes they weren't. Cheney and Powell had a history going back to the first Bush administration that was, on the one hand, collegial, and on the other hand, under the surface, there was a good degree of tension. So, no, I don't see it as some unified conspiracy.
James Mann is the author of the new book, Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Toyota and the next generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive, committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Game, a novel of suspense featuring Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes by Laurie R. King. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Must Squirm TV. We meet Robert Whitey, an executive producer and director of the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. The show stars Larry David, who was the co-creator of Seinfeld. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After co-creating and writing the phenomenally popular series Seinfeld, Larry David moved from behind the scenes to star in his own HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm. He plays himself, though for the sake of everyone he knows, I can only hope that in real life he's not nearly as neurotic, self-absorbed, and misanthropic as he is in the series. But his flaws are what make the show so funny. And as critic Ken Tucker says, quote, "You will feel guilty for laughing so hard, which is, I suspect, precisely the reaction David wants," unquote. My guest, Robert Whitey, is an executive producer and director of the series. Whitey has also made documentaries about his comic heroes, including Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, and the Marx Brothers. That documentary background came in especially handy for the pilot of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which was a mock documentary about Larry David preparing for an HBO special. Before we meet Whitey, here's a scene from a recent episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Larry David is speaking with his agent, played by Jeff Garlin.
Hey, what's going on with your gal down the hall there? She's crying and...
I'm having a lot of problems with her. You know, first of all, her boyfriend broke up with her.
Yeah.
And frankly, I'd like to do the same.
Why don't you fire her?
I can't.
Why?
Because she knows everything about me. She knows my dietary habits. She knows about all my web of lies and bullshit and deceit. She knows more about me than Cheryl does.
You can't fire her.
She'll destroy me.
You're trapped.
I'm trapped for life. And she doesn't want to do anything else with her life. This is it.
Oh, dear God, you're trapped.
You know what else she knows? She knows about this one.
Oh, man, it came. Wow, college girl's gone wild. Look at that. You know what? We can go to my house and watch it.
Oh, yeah. We'll have, like, an autofocus
party. Autofocus party? I got the big screen. You can watch it.
Which character are you going to be?
I'm Bob Crane.
Are you Bob Crane?
I'm Bob. You can be the freakish guy.
I'll be Willem Dafoe.
You'll be Willem Dafoe. You're the freak.
Is there a kind of great Larry David moment from one of the episodes that's based on something that happened in real life to him, preferably something that happened when you were there?
Oh, yeah, lots of those. I mean, when you start to spend time with Larry, especially now with the show, and I'm certain this happened during the Seinfeld years too, is you do get in situations with him and you realize, oh boy, this is going to wind up on TV at some point. And Larry does have a little book. In fact, we featured it on one of the episodes in the first season, this little notebook that he carries with him. It's a pocket-sized book. And you see Larry take out the notebook and he makes a note, and that's something that will become a storyline down the road. There have been so many things I've experienced with him. I remember my wife and I a couple of years ago were taking a walk in the neighborhood, and a woman came up to us, an older woman, and just started to talk, and she was complaining about back pain, and we asked her, you know, what happened to her back. And she talked about having house guests at her house, and somebody left the toilet seat up, and she literally fell into the toilet and injured her back, and it had been a problem now for several months. And I told that to Larry, and he just thought that was great, and I saw him write it down in the book, and that became a story this year. So, anything is fair game, and most of the stories are at least based on a nut of something autobiographical, something that's actually taken place.
Now, you mentioned the thing about leaving the toilet seat up and falling into mm-hmm. the toilet. Mm-hmm. In this episode, the comic Shelley Berman plays Larry David's father, and they're actually having a talk with each other about the importance of leaving the seat down for Larry David because he sits. Right. He sits when he urinates.
One of the few men who will admit to it, I guess.
Yes, and let's play the scene in which he admits to it and explains why.
Hey, Pop. Hmm? Do me a favor, okay? Next time you use the bathroom, make sure to keep the seat down.
What are you, pushing away?
It's not really about her, it's about me. I pee sitting down.
How long have you been doing that?
Well, it started because I was getting up to go at night sometimes, And I didn't feel like putting the light on, so I would sit down, and then I got very comfortable with it.
A man doesn't do that. A man stands up to pee.
Like to sit down, and I don't want to wind up in the toilet because you're keeping the seat up. Keep the seat down.
Oh, you stand like a person. I'm very upset with this. This is crazy.
You know what Winston Churchill said? Why stand when you can sit? Have you ever heard that expression?
No, I never heard that expression, but I don't think he meant in the toilet.
It's a scene from an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, the Larry David Show. My guest, Robert Whitey, is an executive producer and director of the show. Was it your idea to cast the comic Shelley Berman as Larry David's father?
Well, it wasn't my idea per se, although all of us on the show, Larry David, myself, Jeff Garland, Larry Charles, were all big fans of that era of stand-up comedy, and that was the stuff we grew up on, watching on The Tonight Show and The Ed Sullivan Show. So a lot of these comics who aren't working that much these days to us are big heroes. And so Shelley, just like any number of actors, came in and auditioned for that part. We were so thrilled to have him by because we're big fans of his. And he just was so funny in the audition. And I guess it's no secret now with our show, but Shelley, generally when he works, he has hair. Let's put it that way. He wears a piece. I think I can say that. And he did the audition with his hairpiece on. And so Larry went running out to him down the hallway afterwards, saying, "Shelley, you were great. We love you. We want you to do the show. I just want to ask you one thing." And Shelley said, "You want to know if I'll work without the piece?" And that, in fact, was it.
How did he know Larry's... that?
He could feel it. He told us later he knew coming in we were going to ask him if he would work without his hair. And he agreed to do it because we thought Larry's father should be bald. And so I told Shelley, you know, what you can do is instead of admitting now that you've worn a piece all this time, just tell people you shave your head for the show. So I don't know if he's using that, but I thought that was an easy way out.
Do you keep a notebook of obnoxious moments that you could contribute to the show?
I'm not quite that organized, but yes, I do bring Larry ideas, as do other people on the show. And Larry Charles is another producer on the show, and Jeff Garland, who plays Larry's manager, Jeff Green, and Cheryl. We've all tossed in stories which have wound up on the air. There was actually a few years ago, a friend of mine passed away, and it was all very sad, but the friends got together that night of the funeral. And, you know, my friend lived alone and he wasn't married. And there was talk about if, you know, his family would eventually be going through his apartment and gathering things. And one of us said, "Gee, should we go in there first and sort of make a run and see if there's anything that, you know, maybe he wouldn't want his family to discover?" And so after a little bit of drinking, we all decided that we should sort of have an understanding that we do that with each other. And if anybody, you know, went prematurely, the others would go into, you know, their home or apartment and start to look to see if there was, you know, any magazines or anything lying about. And so I brought that to Larry, and that wound up being a story in season one, I guess it was, the Porno Gill episode, where Jeff is in the hospital. He's about to have some emergency bypass and asks Larry to go to his house, tells him where the secret stash of pornography is, and asks Larry to gather it up so his wife doesn't find it if, God forbid, something happens on the operating table. But Larry's brilliance, again, was weaving that into a story that he already had about this ex-porno star. And when Larry goes into the house and finds the stash, he finds a tape that, you know, this friend that he just had dinner with appears in and puts it on, and then Jeff's parents walk in. So he can take these ideas and just find a way to fashion them into something way beyond anything you could imagine would ever be that funny.
Well, let's hear a scene from the Porno Gill episode. And this is from Curb Your Enthusiasm, the Larry David Show.
This key right here.
Mysterious.
Very mysterious. This key right here, my front door. I need you to go into my house, okay? Go up to my bedroom, to the left of the TV. There's a cabinet by the bookcase there. Open it up, move the linens. There's linens in there. Move them to the side, push on the back door, and it'll open up. Inside there, I have like my porn collection. I have like 7-8 porn tapes, a couple of magazines, all right? I need you to get them out of there. You got to get it out of there because if something happens to me...
Oh, right, you're thinking like if the anesthesia, something goes wrong.
Anything goes wrong.
So in case you die, you don't want your wife to discover your porno stuff?
She doesn't understand that. I'm not embarrassed in front of anybody.
I don't really understand it either, but okay, that's okay.
That's your own deal.
Yeah, okay.
That's your own deal, Repression
but,
Jones.
Know, well, what about, is there an alarm code or anything like that?
Easy. 9988.
I better write that down.
In there should be a pen and a piece of paper.
9988. Okay.
I can't believe you have to write it down.
What am I going to do with these things?
Keep it in your trunk.
What if I get in an accident on the way home? What about that? And this
porn goes flying everywhere,
strewn all over the car, and all over my bleeding body. You'll this be alarm fine. Code. I'm worried about this too.
Oh, nothing's gonna happen.
I'm no good with stuff like that. It's too technical for me.
9988.
The alarm's gonna go off. There'll be a SWAT team descending on me. This whole thing just has disaster written all over it.
It'll be fine. I trust me.
And your wife better not show up.
Yeah, I guarantee she's not gonna be there. She'll be here. I appreciate it. You're a great pal. I appreciate it.
Try not to die.
Try not to die. Thank you.
A scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm. We'll talk more about the series with executive producer and director Robert Whitey after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Whitey, an executive producer and director of the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm, starring Larry David as himself. Now, the show is part scripted, part improvised. How does it work? The storyline is scripted, but the actual dialogue is improvised?
We go in with, it's actually grown over the years. The first season, the average story outline was maybe 5 pages. Now they've expanded a bit. Larry writes a little more detail. They're up to 7, sometimes as many as 8 pages. But we go in knowing absolutely what the story is going to be and basically what has to take place in each scene. But there is virtually no written dialogue for the actors. The actors are brought onto the set, generally having no idea what they're going to do. And my standard joke has become that they're given information on a need-to-know basis. It's like working for the CIA. And when I'm directing, I will just give the actors what information their character would know in the scene and give them a general sense of direction about what's going to take place in the scene. But they make it up as they go. And we cast from a pool of talented improvisational actors, primarily here in L.A., and we just let them go. So we know basically what has to happen in each scene, and we know what marks to hit, but we love the spontaneity of people making it up as they go. And we'll just shoot each scene as many times as we have to until we know we've got something to work with, and then we continue to hone it in the editing room.
What are some of the different requirements for you as a director when you're working with improvisation compared to working with something scripted?
Well, it becomes a little harder to sort of block the shots for camera. We sort of take a documentary approach in that anything can happen, so let's just make sure that we catch it on camera. And we do shoot with 2 cameras. And my instructions for the crew is to always have a camera on Larry because so much of the comedy has to do with his reactions. And you just want the scene covered because things will spontaneously happen. Actors will say things that if you don't catch it on camera the first time, then you'd have to go back and recreate it and lose the spontaneity. So basically, the first take will be some sort of general master shot that will catch as much of the action as possible with the camera on Larry. And then we do the scene several times. The actors are given notes. We continue to hone it. And then it's just a matter about getting the right coverage for camera so that we can cut it together in the editing room. We wind up with a lot of footage, and we spend much more time in the editing room than we actually do on the set. The shows take on an average 5 to 7 days to shoot. But we're in the editing room easily for 3 weeks on each episode.
How did you start working with Larry David?
Larry and I have known each other for more than 20 years now, and we met initially. I was heading up development for the production management team of Rollins and Joffe, who produce all of Woody Allen's movies and have been with him from the beginning. And, oh, they've managed every great comedian from Robin Williams to Billy Crystal to Robert Klein and Martin Short and on and on. But I was their development person about 20 years ago, a little more. And so one of my duties was to read scripts that came in for non-Woody Allen projects. And a script came on my desk called Prognosis Negative, and I read it, and it was one of the funniest scripts I'd ever read. And I said to the guys, well, we have to bring in this writer, Larry David. This is such a funny script. And we all did know Larry because Larry, at that time, had appeared on a show called Fridays, which was a late-night variety comedy show. So we brought Larry in for these meetings. Now, the story of Prognosis Negative was typical Larry David. It was about a fellow much like Larry. This was, again, years ago, so it would have been the younger Larry, who was single, who was dating and just could never make a commitment to a woman. And he'd go through one relationship after another because he couldn't commit. And then finally he finds out that a woman that he dated a few years ago, who was nice, he quite liked her, finds out that she's terminally ill and that she doesn't know it. That's the beautiful thing. He finds out accidentally from a doctor. And so he thinks, well, this is the perfect relationship because I can go out with her and I can commit to her. And in, what she got, 6 months? In 6 months, it'll be over. So that was sort of the basis of the story. So so Larry would come in for these meetings with myself and the executives there. And the executives would say to Larry, you know, we love the script. It's very, very funny. But, boy, this character, you know, he's not very sympathetic. Do you think there's anything you can do to make him a little more sympathetic, a little more likable? And Larry would think about it and then say, no, I don't think so. No, not at all. So it was more important to him to sort of stick to his guns about that character rather than make an easy sale to get the film made and to change it. So I just thought, well, I like this guy. I like his way of thinking. So we started to hang out. I'd go to the clubs with him, the comedy clubs. He was doing stand-up in those days. And so many nights I'd be with him in the clubs and he'd be on stage performing. And some nights he'd do rather well, but there were nights when he would just bomb terribly. And I would just be in the back of the room laughing because I thought the material was brilliant and the audiences did not know what to make of him. And they would just stare up at him like carp in a pond. And I remember thinking, boy, if the country ever caught up to this guy's sense of humor, there'll be chaos in the streets.
What was his stand-up act like?
Well, it was unlike anything else I had seen. First of all, Larry would come out on stage, and there was no good evening, how are you, anything like that. He actually looked a little bit like a deer caught in the headlights behind that microphone. And this is one night I remember. This was sort of typical of what he would do. He would come out on stage, and the first thing he'd say was, "Every morning I wake up and thank God that I wasn't born a wealthy Spanish landowner."
Because what?
Which is, you know, a typical opening for a comedy monologue. He said, "Because if I were, I would never know whether to address the help using the to form or the usted form." He'd say, "If I use the usted form, I don't want them to feel I'm being condescending, yet if I use the to form, I don't want them to feel so familiar that they can just come into my kitchen and help themselves to anything in my refrigerator." And that would be the kind of thing that would just knock me on the floor, because to me that was a very sort of Robert Benchley-esque sort of concept, something that harkened back to the days of Benchley and Perlman and those great wits. But the audience was, you know, usually it was 1:30 in the morning and they were sort of drunk and they wanted the, you know, the obvious sex jokes. And I'm telling you, I would be hysterical, but people would be throwing things at him. People would be shouting to him to get off the stage. And Larry has a very combative personality, so he was no shrinking violet. He would start shouting back at the audience. And then there would be the people in the audience who were ready to jump up there and punch him, and then other people who'd be shouting at them to, you know, let him talk. And this melee would break out in the audience for the pro-Larry faction and the anti-Larry faction. And I saw that happen on more than one night.
Now, you mentioned Prognosis Negative, the screenplay that he wrote that you had looked at while you were working for Rollins and Jaffe. And that's a running gag in Seinfeld. There's a movie called Prognosis Negative that's playing at the theaters. So I didn't realize that that came.
Yeah,
from.
that was an in joke for the, you know, 12 people who knew about the script. But what was amazing about Larry was this sense of humor, which seemed to be so unmarketable in a way, which seemed to be so distinct and so offbeat and anything but mainstream, anything but made for television, was turned into this show magically that became really the most successful comedy series in the history of television. And those of us who knew Larry and knew his sense of humor just watched the show and sat there shaking our heads saying, he did it, he found a way to do it. And I think a lot of that had to do with Larry's very unique, wonderful comic sensibility being meshed with Seinfeld, who is himself just a very acceptable, likable, palatable person. And I think it was that mix, and this analogy has been made 100 times, sort of the Lennon-McCartney thing, which both Larry and Jerry can't stand to hear. But I think there is something to that. I think the two of them coming together just worked beautifully.
My guest is Robert Wydy. He's an executive producer and director of Curb Your Enthusiasm on HBO. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Whitey, an executive producer and director of the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm, starring Larry David as himself. Since you've directed so many documentaries about comics, I'm wondering where you think Larry David fits into modern comedy. Because he's kind of like an insult comic, but it's not like he's Don Rickles or something. I mean, it's more like obnoxious than insulting, though he insults people all around, but there are people in his real world, since this is a sitcom.
Right. Well, what is interesting is, as schooled as I was in the great comedians, both of the silent era and, you know, the golden age, the 30s, Larry is familiar with very little of that. He's never seen a complete Marx Brothers movie or a W.C. Fields movie, and this is the stuff I grew up on. And Larry and I, a couple of years ago, went to a Harold Lloyd film. It was the first time he had seen Harold Lloyd, maybe the first time he had seen an entire silent feature. And afterwards, we walked out of that theater, and his jaw was agape, and he just said, "My God, that was so funny. I didn't know that silent films were so funny." I said, "Yeah, they can be. I don't know if you've been exposed to them before, but that really was his first exposure." And he really grew up. The only real influences that I've known him to cite have been Abbott and Costello, and really from the TV years more than from their films, and Phil Silvers and Bilko and all of that. But that's what's interesting, is that he is that intuitive. He doesn't give a second thought to really his comic persona in any sort of historical sense. And I'm always thinking about that. And it even informs the way sometimes I'll direct or stage things, or what I'll contribute to stories, whatever. If Larry is doing battle with a little kid, well, that can be uncomfortable unless that little kid has really done something to deserve Larry's wrath. And that was sort of W.C. Fields' thing, is that he could go after Baby Leroy, but only after Baby Leroy dumped Fields' pocket watch into the molasses and was acting like a real brat. And sometimes with Larry and Jeff, I'll stage things in the way that Laurel and Hardy would do it, where if they're facing Jeff's wife, Susie, who's screaming at them, Larry will sort of hide behind Jeff's girth, which is a very kind of Laurel and Hardy move. So I'm always thinking about those things and thinking about Larry's place, in sort of that chronology of great comedians, but he doesn't give it a second thought.
This season, Larry David has been cast by Mel Brooks in The Producers, in the role of Max Bialystock, originated by Nathan Lane. How did that plot idea get hatched?
Larry and I were actually in New York a few years ago, I think, doing some publicity for maybe it was the second season or the third season, and we saw The Producers in New York, not with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, but another cast that was in. And Larry, just watching these people on stage singing and dancing, just was flabbergasted. How did they do that? How do they memorize all that? How do they know all the steps? And he just thought it was the scariest notion in the world. And then he started to think, geez, what if I were put in that situation where I had to do all that? And again, that was just an idea that grew out of that moment of seeing the show. And the season finale this year is the opening night of The Producers on Broadway, and audiences can see if disaster strikes or not when Larry takes to the boards.
Well, Robert Whitey, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Robert Whitey is an executive producer and director of the HBO series Curb Your Enthusiasm, starring Larry David. The season finale is this Sunday. Here's a scene from earlier in the season. Ben Stiller and Larry David are on their way to a rehearsal for The Producers, and they've just dropped off Stiller's wife at her yoga class. Larry David is still in the back seat.
Why don't you come up front?
I'm okay.
Come on up front.
I'm good.
Are you serious?
Yeah, why? What's the difference?
Larry, I'm not going to drive you around like I'm your chauffeur. Get in the f***ing front seat, all right?
Ben, you're not driving me around like I'm a chauffeur with 2 minutes from the rehearsal hall.
You know, what kind of person asks another person to drive him around like this? This kind of mentality is what's...
Whoa, what kind of person is so insecure that they have to make somebody move into the front seat so they don't think that they're driving somebody around?
No, the kind of person that's so insecure that needs to be driven around in the back seat, subliminally telling
to do
me
with
that you need
around.
Me to drive
why
you around.
Why leave my seat? Go into the front seat.
Because I asked you to sit in the front seat of my car, and it's my car, and it's my car. I make the rules, okay?
Oh, you're making the rules?
Yeah, we
would have already been there already.
Yes, he would have already.
Very good. Very good. Oh, you can't drive with somebody in the back seat.
Yeah, you're such a baby. You're a grown man baby.
Are you saying I'm a man child?
I'm saying you're a little baby. And I'll get, you know what? Little baby wants to ride, we'll give little baby a ride.
You know what? Little baby wants to walk.
No, little baby.
Little baby's going to walk.
No, you know what? I should have brought my little baby seat for my
little baby.
No, Mr. David, where to now? Where to now, Mr. David?
Oh, I know. I didn't read the rules getting into the car.
Here we go. Driving Mr. Larry.
Hey, take it easy, man.
Larry David and Ben Stiller in a scene from Curb Your Enthusiasm. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberto Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with the showstopper from the producers.
Germany, Deutschland is happy and king. We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Rhineland's a fine land once more. Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Watch out, Europe, we're going on tour. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Look, it's springtime.
Winter for and France.
Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Springtime. Come on, the Germans, go into your dance.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
During the Cold War, Thomas Reed worked on the design of nuclear weapons, and under President Reagan, he served as Secretary of the Air Force and National Security Assistant. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his new book, At the Abyss, An Insider's History of the Cold War. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.